Well, thank you. It's a terrific privilege to be here, so thank you for the invitation. Today, I'm going to be talking about whether or not it's rational to believe in miracles. So I'm going to be taking a more epistemological approach. So far, we've been hearing about the metaphysics of miracles. I'm going to concentrate on the epistemology. Is it rational to believe in miracles? Miracles are all over, both the Old Testament and New Testament stories. And for most Christians, I think, they play an important role in explaining why people believe. They're moved by the miracles they find in the Old Testament, the miracles of Jesus, the miracles of the apostles. They find it both inspiring and also an important aspect of a relationship between God and humanity. And so it does play, I think, a significant role in religious belief, as well as a significant role in general in our approach to the theory of knowledge, to understand whether it could be rational to believe in miracles. My talk today is going to have five parts. I'm going to talk a little bit at the beginning about how I understand miracles. You've already heard a lot about definitions of the word miracle, so I'll go through that fairly quickly. But it is important that I build in a bit of epistemology to that to help me answer the question of whether it can be rational to believe in miracles. Then I want to look at Hume's argument, not from the point of view of the impossibility, conceptual or otherwise, of miracles, but instead from an epistemic point of view. Can it ever make sense to believe in miracles? And then I'm going to essentially say that Hume gets it, well, right in one important respect, but wrong in some very fundamental respects. First of all, the number of witnesses makes a crucial difference. I've made that argument before, but I want to extend it by making the point that it's true in general of experiences. That is to say, it's not only testimony that you find in biblical sources, for example, or testimony from those who have witnessed a miracle, but also your own experiences. After all, there are two questions here, really. Whether I should believe a miracle report based on what someone else says, and what it would take for me to count one of my own experiences as miraculous. And then I want to talk about context sensitivity, ways in which one miracle or report of a miracle changes the calculus for how we should think about subsequent reports of miracles or subsequent experiences of something miraculous. And finally, I want to suggest there's something about this that a lot of discussions in the academic literature miss, but that I think is part of a common sense attitude toward these things, which is that miracles, in particular in context, reframe the context, change the way we think about the entire circumstance we're in. That's part of the reason they seem so fundamental to so many people, to their particular relationship with God. If we don't reframe the context, then we keep viewing, as one of our previous speakers said, all of these things in isolation and don't understand the way in which they interact to tell a larger story and have a larger significance. Well, let me start with Thomas on miracles. He begins by saying a miracle properly so-called is when something is done outside the order of nature. So for a miracle, it's required that it be against the order of the whole of created nature. Ordinem totius naturae creatae. And if we think about that, there are really two things being said there, outside the order of nature, but also against the order of nature. Those are really not quite the same thing. So after some discussion, he points out that properly speaking, we should say that miracles are works done by God outside the order, usually observed in things. Well, here is the way I'm going to think about things for several reasons. One is it can be difficult to identify God as a causal agent. We've already heard something about those metaphysical difficulties. There are analogous epistemic difficulties. But also, I don't want to say that we have to, as it were, rule out all possible naturalistic explanations, partly because God can act through secondary causes, and partly because it may be that in some cases, the improbability of a combination of natural causes would simply be more remarkable than actual supernatural agency. And I'll talk more about how that might work in a few minutes. So let's think about some fundamental miracles. And the one I'm going to concentrate on most here is the one that I think is absolutely the central miracle of the Christian tradition, the resurrection of Christ. And by the way, I'm showing you some artworks here, most of which are here in Italy. And I'm doing it partly because, in case any of my students watch this, they need exposure to art that is of a higher level than a Taylor Swift song. But anyway, it does seem to me that the glorification of the resurrection of Christ is absolutely central to Christian belief, and it's not easily explained in some other ways. And I'll say more about that in a little bit. But I want to appeal here to the words of Paul in 1 Corinthians. First and foremost, I handed on to you the facts which had been imparted to me, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised to life on the third day according to the Scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas and afterwards to the 12. Then he appeared to over 500 of our brothers at once, most of whom are still alive, though some have died. Then he appeared to James and afterward to all the apostles. In the end, he appeared even to me. Paul is saying that this is something that should convince even the unbeliever that Christ died for our sins, was resurrected, and was observed subsequently by 500 people, most of whom are still alive. Now, he's saying this, notice, at a time in the early 50s when many of those people would still have been around. Now, if you are in Corinth, maybe you don't know people who actually had this experience, but if you were in Jerusalem, for example, and even in Corinth, with some people founding the church there, you may well be able to talk to eyewitnesses. And he does see this as central. He says, if Christ was not raised, then our gospel is null and void, and so is your faith, and we turn out to be lying witnesses for God. So for Paul, at least, this is really fundamental. If we don't get the question of miracles right, then there's a lot in the faith that we should worry about. Now, I think that's something observed by others. Here's a poem by John Updike, Seven Stanzas at Easter. And one of the stanzas is this: make no mistake, if he rose at all, it was as his body. If the cell's dissolution did not reverse, the molecules re-knit, the amino acids rekindle, the church will fall. And Thomas says the miracles worked by Christ were arguments for the faith which he taught. Now, you might think they're absolutely central and necessary arguments. You might think they're simply helpful arguments and are perhaps not necessary. But in any case, they seem to be important arguments, and arguments that, at least within the philosophical tradition, have tended to be dismissed, have not tended to be taken very seriously until quite recently. Now, I think if we look at what Thomas has to say about this, about the role of miracles in the justification of belief, it's actually very helpful. The miracles which Christ worked, he said, were a sufficient proof of his Godhead in three respects. First, as to the very nature of the works, which surpassed the entire capability of created power, and therefore couldn't be done save by divine power. Second, as to the way in which he worked miracles, namely because he worked miracles as though of his own power, and not by praying as others do. And third, from the very fact that he taught that he was God, for unless this were true, it would not be confirmed by miracles worked by divine power. So he sees the argument for God's existence and for Christ's divinity as resting on these three aspects of miracles. Now, is it rational to actually believe any of this, whether it's absolutely central to Christianity or not? Does it make sense? Well, if you think about what it is to rationally believe something, it's not an easy question to answer. And in the philosophical literature, there are basically five approaches to this question, five approaches to addressing the issue of when it's rational to believe something. They fall into two broad categories, evidentialism and non-evidentialism. The strictest by far is strict evidentialism. It says, essentially, you have to have evidence, and you have to have sufficient evidence for your belief to count as rational. And so the strict evidentialist is going to say, look, you have to have enough evidence. A rational person proportions his belief to the evidence. That's exactly what Hume says in his discussion of this. He thinks, basically, there's never sufficient evidence for a miracle report. But in any case, he sees it as our obligation to proportion our belief to the evidence. Brand Blanchard put it a little differently. The ideal is believe no more, but also no less than what the evidence warrants. Well, if we're strict evidentialists, then we need to think, how strong is the evidence, actually? And to some extent, that, of course, becomes a historical, not a philosophical question. But that isn't the only attitude. Moderate evidentialists say, well, there generally has to be enough evidence. That is to say, what the strict evidentialist says is an absolutely necessary requirement. The moderate evidentialist says, well, it's an ideal. Normally, that's what we want. But there may be circumstances where we accept belief and count it as rational without strictly having enough evidence for it, going a bit beyond the evidence. In fact, you might argue that we always do that when we make universal claims, like all ravens are black, or all particles obey the laws of physics. In all of those cases, we really never have quite enough evidence to justify the universal quantification, but nevertheless, we accept those things as rational beliefs. There has to be enough, but maybe not sufficient in the same sense. Non-evidentialists think that in a lot of cases, more systematically, we can go beyond what the evidence actually supports. That might be true for practical reasons. For example, the surgeon has to decide. A patient is desperately ill. The surgeon has to make a decision about whether or not to operate or pursue some other course of treatment. There isn't time to wait and see what happens and gather more evidence. Whatever the surgeon does, there will not be sufficient evidence to support that decision. Now, the surgeon might make the decision without having a rational belief, but we'd like to think surgery proceeds on a rational basis. And so the practical non-evidentialist says, look, in such cases, we set aside these concerns and we say it's rational to go with whatever you have the most evidence for, whether or not it's really adequate evidence in a general sense. Conservative non-evidentialists appeal to undefeated intuitions. They can say, look, instead of saying I have to have evidence for these propositions, I come built in, perhaps a priori, perhaps just through general experience with certain kinds of beliefs. Maybe it's a matter of my upbringing or my culture. And I am entitled to continue to hold those beliefs as long as evidence doesn't contradict them. So if I have a strong intuition, for example, that killing innocent people is wrong, I don't need evidence for that claim. Until I would find some very powerful argument or evidence against it, I'm entitled to keep believing that. And then finally, there is fideistic non-evidentialism that says, look, at some points, a rational person simply must take a leap of faith. And indeed, some Christians have said, that's what my faith rests on, a leap of faith that goes beyond the evidence. I don't think it's irrational. In fact, often they argue, as Santayana does, for example, in his book on animal faith, that everybody takes a leap of faith at some point, a leap of faith into naturalism, a leap of faith into theism, or something else. Well, I think Paul is trying to make an argument that actually a belief in miracles should survive all of these possible tests. That is to say, even the strict evidentialist he wants to appeal to and say there is enough evidence in those strict terms for the existence of miracles and thereby for divine agency. Now, it may not be necessary to defend the rationality of belief. By holding that, we could think that, well, we have to retreat to moderate evidentialism or some form of non-evidentialism. But Paul doesn't think we do. Paul is convinced that no, even by the strictest standards, Christian belief and specifically belief in miracles pass the test. Now, there are two other things I want to remark on about miracles as a special path toward understanding God. The first is that miracles seem to give us a connection that is independent of particular concepts of God. Here is a Rembrandt drawing of Moses at the burning bush. What is it that is causing this anomalous phenomenon that Moses observes? Well, he doesn't have to have a concept of God. He doesn't have to have some general argument for God. Instead, he sees something and is inspired to think in terms of something supernatural going on, independently of any particular religious tradition or any kind of definition of what God is. And so there is a sense in which miracles are unlike other arguments for God's existence, which typically do start from some conception of God as the perfect being, for example, or as that the greatest, greater than which cannot be conceived, or as the first cause or the prime mover, or the absolutely necessary and independent existence. This is something that is independent of all that. And moreover, it seems to grant de re knowledge of God, a de re causal connection to God that other kinds of arguments for religious belief don't. So one of the more puzzling arguments I've encountered among those who are skeptical of belief in miracles is to think that there's some kind of tension between these two aspects, that one would have to have a particular concept of God and a particular justification for believing in that God before actually attributing a miracle and having something like de re knowledge of God. Now, it seems to me that's an incoherent thought. There is no such need. If I have a direct causal connection with something, I don't have to have an idea of what it is to have some conception of that thing. I might, in summertime, look up and I see a light flash in the sky. And what is it? I can have a de re awareness of that thing as that thing I saw, that flash in the sky, without knowing whether that was a meteor, whether it was some kind of light, whether it was an airplane, a satellite going overhead, whether it was something else. I may not know what it was. I don't have to have some proof of the existence of something before saying I actually have a causal relationship with that thing. So far from being a weakness of an argument from miracles, it seems to me actually a great strength that miracles give us a de re connection to God himself, apart from any concept of God we might in particular have. There's one other aspect of any kind of consideration of miracles and the rationality of belief in miracles that I think is really important. That is to say, this is a kind of historical theory or a historical approach to understanding God. There is some kind of initial experience someone has that they take to be an experience of a miracle. And in that way, they acquire the belief that they have experienced something miraculous. Then they tell others and they witness to others who may well or may not acquire that belief that something miraculous has occurred. So if we think about the question of rationality here, we have to think about it in at least two ways. First of all, the problem of acquisition. That is to say, when would it be rational for you to count an experience of your own as a miraculous experience? And then secondly, the question of transfer. When is it rational for you to accept someone else's report of a miracle, a report in scripture, a report from someone you know, a report you've read about? In those cases, there's a kind of transfer going on. When would it be rational to accept a belief in miracles on the basis of testimony from someone else who actually rationally believes it? So let's talk a little bit about the problem of acquisition, acquiring a belief that a miracle has occurred. What would that be like? We'd have to think about perception and what would be rational. What it would be rational to infer from your perception of a certain event. For example, think about the storm on the Sea of Galilee, where a storm is going on, Jesus is sleeping through it, the disciples wake him up, worried, and he calms the sea. And they are asking, who is this man? Such that the wind and the seas obey him. They took that as a sign of a miracle. And it seems to me that it's actually very hard to maintain the thesis that no experience we could have would count as an experience of a miracle. Or that is to say, it would to claim that it would always be irrational to infer that a miracle occurred. If we asked for a sign, and indeed God gave us a sign, I said, God, are you real? And up there, we saw flashing across the screen, yes, I am real. That would be pretty powerful evidence. Now, we could think, oh, there's some kind of trick being played. We could look for a projector or something like that. But the fact is, I think for any of us, there would be a kind of experience we could have that would justify the belief that we had witnessed a miracle. The second sort of problem is about transfer. And for most of us, that's the real problem. Other people have witnessed miracles or things that they took to be miraculous and reported. They give testimony about it. And then the question is, when would it be rational to believe such a report? Here, Paul preaching on the ruins, his audience is faced with a question, should I believe this man? And when would it be rational for them to believe it? I'm going to talk first about the problem of transfer and testimony of miracles, partly because that's been by far the most investigated in philosophy, and it's also the one that a lot of philosophers take to be just fatal. Following Hume, who has been, I think, undeservedly popular in his analysis of this. So John Herman Randall, for example, has said, Hume delivered a coup de grace to rational belief in miracles. Why? He proved so conclusively that intelligent men have rarely questioned it since, that a miracle in the sense of a supernatural event as a sign of the divinity of its worker cannot possibly be established. Well, what does Hume actually say? We've already seen some quotations from Hume saying a miracle is a violation of the laws of nature. But of course, given Hume's conception of laws of nature, it's a little bit odd to interpret this, because after all, he doesn't believe in necessary connections. He doesn't believe in causation. He is somebody who's a skeptic about all of that. And so he doesn't really mean law of nature in the sense that most people today mean it. Instead, he really says, look, all of human experience, except for this, go against this sort of claim. So the proportions of the evidence are always against believing in a miracle. Now, if we just start with violations of laws of nature, well, it's clearly neither necessary nor sufficient. It isn't necessary for a miracle. Lots of biblical miracles don't require laws of nature, as we've seen. God can act through secondary causes. Plagues of locusts, flies, frogs, sounds like West Texas. This does not require, you know, suspension of any laws of nature. And really, well, if we look again at Thomas on the power of God, the third degree of miracles is when God does what is wont to be done by the operation of nature, but without the operation of natural principles. When by the power of God, a man is cured of a fever that nature is able to cure, or when it rains without the operation of the principles of nature, or when water turns into wine, usually grapes are required, but not always. A miracle is done by God without nature when he produces an effect that nature can produce, but in a manner of which nature is incapable. It's also not sufficient. The attribution of agency does seem to require purpose. We've heard a lot about that as well, so I won't talk much about it, but we need to think, look, miracles are works done by God. It would only be reasonable to think that God was behind some anomaly, for example, that we observed, if we see some purpose in it, some purpose that God could actually be accomplishing. If we observed some kind of violation of an astronomical law, we couldn't find any physical explanation of it, would we attribute it to supernatural agency? Probably we would think there is some previously unconceived aspect of nature. Why? Not because we had found it or had any theory of it, but simply because we couldn't sense any divine purpose in actually wobbling a certain planet's orbit. So we have to think, look, God does this for a reason, first and principally in confirmation of the doctrine that a man teaches, since those things which are of faith surpass human reason, they can't be proved by human arguments, but need to be proved by the argument of divine power, so that when a man does works that God alone can do, we may believe what he says is from God. Just as when a man is the bearer of letters sealed with the king's ring, it's to be believed that what they contain expresses the king's will. And secondly, in order to make known God's presence in a man by the grace of the Holy Spirit, so that when a man does the works of God, we may believe that God dwells in him by his grace. Wherefore it is written, he who giveth to you the Spirit and worketh miracles among you. Those are purposes. And there may well be other purposes connected to human flourishing and other things we think of as divine purposes. But that does seem necessary, so something that is simply anomalous isn't quite right. As Thomas points to John, saying, though you will not believe me, believe the works which the Father hath given me to me to perfect themselves give testimony to me. Now, there are other aspects of this, too, which haven't been touched on today. It's not clear, for example, what it would be to violate a statistical law or what the laws governing extremely low probability events really are and how we should understand those. So it's very hard in the case of a lot of modern science to really understand what it would be to identify a violation of a law of nature. So we might approach it, as Thomas does, thinking about miracles as being produced by God's power alone, on things that have a natural tendency to the opposite effect or a contrary mode of operation. We could simply say, as I've been trying to say from an epistemic point of view, they are events the best explanation for which involves divine agency. Now, what is Hume's argument against the existence, or, well, I should say, the rationality of belief in miracles, the existence of a rational belief in miracles? He says, suppose the fact that testimony endeavors to establish partakes of the extraordinary and the marvelous. In that case, the evidence resulting from the testimony admits of a diminution, greater or less, in proportion as the fact is more or less unusual. I shouldn't believe such a story were it told to me by Cato, was a proverbial saying in Rome, even during the lifetime of that philosophical patriot. Since I got here a few days ago, I haven't heard anyone say that, but maybe it's not true anymore. The incredibility of a fact that was allowed might invalidate so great an authority. Well, he's putting this in rather odd terms, but in effect he's saying, look, the likelihood of that report being true is always less than the evidence that it's not true, simply because the event itself is so improbable. We might try to make this precise, as a number of people have, by thinking about Bayes' theorem and the way in which we think about belief in the context of certain things that are highly improbable. And recognize that, look, if base rates of something are low enough, then indeed evidence we have may be a lot weaker than we think. So Bayes' theorem, put in a form that's convenient for us, where M means a miracle happened, C gives us a context. And by the way, you'll often see this with that left out. But I think that's a fundamental mistake in a lot of these discussions. The context makes a huge difference. And then E, that's the evidence we have. Someone testifies, for example, to a miracle. Well, the probability that a miracle has happened, given the context and somebody's testimony, divided by the probability that that miracle did not happen, given that we do have that testimony and in that context. So in other words, the odds that the miracle has actually happened is what's on the left hand of the equality sign. That is, well, what? The probability of the miracle in the context, divided by the probability that the miracle did not occur in that context, times, and now this is the interesting part, the probability that someone would give that testimony, given that a miracle did occur in that context, divided by the probability that they would give that testimony, though the miracle did not occur. So on the right-hand side, we have, first of all, the odds on something like that happening that are presumably very, very low, if it's truly something that is remarkably improbable. And then on the right, the probability that someone is going to be essentially getting it right in reporting the miracle as opposed to getting it wrong. And so we have to temper the likelihood of the person telling the truth by the likelihood of something like that happening at all. Well, two of those quantities are very close to one. After all, we assume that we're talking about something that is extraordinarily unlikely apart from divine agency. So the probability that a miracle wouldn't occur of that kind in that context has to be pretty close to one. In other words, the probability of such a miracle occurring would be very, very low. And then the probability also of someone telling somebody, if they do witness something miraculous, is likely to be pretty close to one. It may not be one. After all, Jesus tells the disciples to keep the messianic secret for a while. Nevertheless, it's going to be high. So those quantities, for the moment, let's ignore, because they're almost one. They are not going to have a significant impact on the result. So what we really have is the odds of the miracle report being true are the odds of the miracle happening at all divided by the odds of somebody getting it wrong. Okay, roughly the odds are favorable, in favor of accepting the miracle report, when the prior probability of the miracle is greater than the prior probability that the source is going to testify mistakenly. Maybe intentionally, maybe they're lying, or maybe just unintentionally. They're confused, they're misperceiving, they're misattributing what went on, etc. So Hume says, when anyone tells me that he saw a dead man restored to life, I immediately consider with myself whether it be more probable that this person should either deceive or be deceived, or that the fact which he relates should really have happened. I weigh the one miracle against the other, and according to the superiority which I discover, I pronounce my decision and always reject the greater miracle. Well, There is a point that he's making that I think is legitimate, and we can understand the point nicely. If we think about a case of medical diagnosis, suppose there is some very rare disease, but there's also a test for that rare disease that is quite likely. The disease strikes one person in a million, but the test is highly accurate. It only gets it wrong, say, one time in a thousand. What are the odds, if the test comes back positive in your case, that you actually have the disease? Now, you might worry a lot. I was actually once in this situation, and I wasn't worried. And maybe I'd like to say it's because I understood Bayesianism, but no, it was simply because perhaps I had a fideistic confidence. I also had an alternative diagnosis that I thought was, I don't have this rare disease, I have cat scratch fever, and I did. It took months for this doctor finally to say, do you even have any cats? And at the time I had 30 cats. And so, well, anyway, never mind. That is off the topic. But the point is this. Actually, for me to have what was an even rarer disease was highly likely, given that I had 30 cats. That's one way in which the context matters. Now here, suppose there is no relevant context. It's simply you have this one test. It's 99.9% accurate, but the disease strikes only one person in a million. What are the odds that you actually have the disease? Only about one in a thousand. So the test is highly reliable, but it is so much less reliable than the general fact that, look, people don't get this disease, that even such a test still does not give you a very high probability that you actually have the illness. But now look what happens in real life if that were to happen. Would they say, look, you're still probably fine? No, they'd give you another test. So suppose there is an independent test of similar accuracy, and we give the person that test. Now, suppose that comes back positive as well. What is the probability the person has the disease? The answer is about one in two. Okay, so now it's about 50-50 with two such tests. Suppose there's a third test. Now, 1,000 to 1 that you do have the disease. Okay, so the number of independent sources of information makes a critical difference. And in this kind of case, it doesn't even take many of these to actually establish that it's highly rational now to believe you have the disease. It seems to me something like that goes on with miracle reports. That is to say, one isolated report of a miracle, it's still rational to believe that it never occurred. But given multiple reports or multiple bits of evidence, it becomes highly rational. So in a case like, well, consider something like the resurrection. Suppose the odds of that are something like 1 in 10 billion, okay? And in this case, maybe we don't have witnesses who are quite as reliable as medical tests, or at least my hypothetical one, 90% accurate. So what are the odds that the miracle actually occurred, given one report of such a thing? Well, Hume's right, 1 in 1 billion, still highly improbable. But suppose we have a second. Roughly every witness is going to correspond in this kind of scenario to an order of magnitude. So now, well, still pretty unlikely, 1 in 100 million. But every witness we add makes it more likely. By the time we get to 10 witnesses, the odds are now 1 in 2. By the time we get to 12 witnesses, the odds are 100 to 1 that it did exist, that it did happen, that the miracle did occur. So the number of sources, the number of independent reports, the number of experiences is critical. And this is true not only in the case of transfer, that is to say, of listening to someone else's report of a miracle. After all, as Charles Babbage pointed out, if independent witnesses can be found who speak truth more frequently than falsehood, it's always possible to assign a number of independent witnesses the improbability of the falsehood of whose concurring testimony shall be greater than the improbability of the alleged miracle. So as long as we have enough witnesses or enough experiences to justify the claim, it becomes rational. And Paley put this dramatically. It's a long quote, so I won't read all of it. But essentially, he's saying, look, if 12 men whose probity and good sense I had long known should seriously relate to me that a miracle had occurred, and if people offer them a short proposal to die for their faith or to recant, and they won't do it, and they end up suffering that faith, and independently, separately, end up being tortured to death in defense of that claim, he says, there wouldn't be a skeptic in the world who wouldn't believe them or who would defend such incredulity in the face of such courage? And I think that's right. Think about the number of people who actually faced serious consequences, and consequences that are, fortunately for most of us today, something we don't have to worry about. You might worry about social disapproval. You might worry even about losing your position, but at least I'm not worried about being crucified. Not yet. We'll see how the future goes. But in any case, these people were put under unbelievable pressure to recant and didn't do it. Now, the point that I want to make is that this sort of argument transfers from the transfer case to the acquisition case as well. That is to say, we can have multiple experiences, not just multiple reports from various sources, but multiple experiences ourselves that would justify a belief in something highly improbable. Here is Van Gogh representing the state lottery office. Would it ever be rational to believe that you had won the lottery? The odds of winning a major lottery are extraordinarily low, actually probably lower than 1 in 10 billion in a lot of cases. And yet people come to believe that they've won the lottery. Now, how is that possible? Well, they have multiple experiences. They have their ticket. They hear the winning numbers read out. They think, that's mine. And then they think, oh, I must be mistaken. And indeed, just from that impression, Bayes' theorem says, yes, you're probably mistaken. But they read the numbers again. They compare an account online. Those are the numbers. They go to the lottery office. They show them the ticket. The person says, yes, indeed. Those are the winning numbers. They actually see the money deposited in their bank account. Multiple experiences. Any one of those experiences might not be enough. If I suddenly found millions of dollars deposited into my bank account, I wouldn't think I've won the lottery. For one thing, I never play the lottery. But also, I would think there's some kind of bizarre criminal activity going on. I wouldn't think anything like, oh, I've won the lottery. Any one of these alone wouldn't be good justification. But we have repeated experiences. And the same thing happens in biblical accounts. Think of the incredulity of St. Thomas. And the story here. 8 days later, the disciples were again together in the house, and Thomas was with them. Although the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them. Now, I put certain words in blue to indicate experiences and the multiple experiences here that are being reported in this short passage. Jesus came and stood among them. And then Jesus speaks. He said, "Peace be with you." Then he says to Thomas, "Put your finger here and examine my hands. Extend your hand and put it to my side. Don't continue your unbelief, but believe." Notice any one of those might have seemed weak evidence. That is to say, the disciples are standing there. They've told Thomas the story. He doesn't believe it. And then there's a momentary presence of Jesus. Then he's gone. That's it. Would that be enough to convince Thomas? Would it be enough to make it rational for a strict evidentialist to believe? Maybe not. But then Jesus is there. He says, "Peace be with you." He says, "Put your finger here, touch my hand, touch my side." And then he speaks again. "Have you believed because you've seen me? Blessed are the people who have not seen and yet believe." So notice what's being said here. There are multiple experiences. This is a continued thing. It isn't just a flash. It isn't just a momentary experience. And so when we think about what Thomas has as justification for a rational belief in the end, we've got something. Let's say the incidence is one in, well, a very, very large number. But now he's got multiple eyewitness reports. And now not just that, but his own experiences, seeing Jesus repeatedly during that encounter, hearing Jesus several different times, touching Jesus's hands, touching Jesus's side. The number of experiences and witnesses together is very large. And so when we think about the experiences of the women at the tomb, for example, or Peter at the tomb, or other experiences that those 500 had after the resurrection, we're talking about not about just momentary flashes or, you know, last night I dreamed about Jesus. It's not like that. These are multiple repeated experiences, quite analogous to my experience of talking to all of you. It's not as if I have this momentary flash of being before an audience. Instead, I keep having that experience, and that repeated experience is further justification. So to close this section, let me comment on what Bertrand Russell said when he was asked, how he would reply if after dying he were brought into the presence of God and asked why he hadn't been a believer. He said, I'd say not enough evidence, God, not enough evidence. But now notice what he doesn't say. He doesn't say, what evidence do I have that I'm in the presence of God now? He doesn't say that. He assumes that he could be in an experience where he does rationally conclude that he is in the presence of God. And so even Russell, complaining there's not enough evidence, admits that there is a kind of experience that would be enough evidence. And presumably, it isn't just a flash of a moment. It is something that actually would consist of an extended encounter with multiple experiences. The same thing is true, by the way, of the disciples at the tomb. I've mentioned that already. I won't go through it all here, but you can see the repeated experiences in that passage. But now let me turn to context sensitivity. First of all, let's think about the plagues of Egypt. Here is a painting of the 10th plague. An event might support rational belief in supernatural agency by being a contributing term in a series of events that support that belief, that support that credence. Biblical miracles, as has already been mentioned today, tend to occur in series. They don't tend to occur in isolation. So we have not only the 10 plagues of Egypt and then the subsequent miracles on the way to the promised land. We have the miracles of Elijah and Elisha. And then, of course, we have the miracles of Jesus himself, here the wedding at Cana, and then the miracles of the disciples afterward. And so here I'll just keep it short since I'm running out of time. But the basic idea is that each of those miracles sets a new context for subsequent reports or experiences of miracles. So someone who has heard or experienced one, like let's say the first plague of Egypt, all right, that seemed really remarkable. Wow, that Moses guy was lucky. Well, what a coincidence. And then the second one occurs. Now you're starting to get worried. The third one? Notice the account keeps saying God hardened Pharaoh's heart, partly because it seems like a rational person, after about three of these plagues, would decide, I better believe him next time. And by the 10th, you start thinking, is the Pharaoh stupid? Why isn't he realizing that it's now highly rational to believe that the next threat is going to be carried out? Well, the account reports, you know, that his heart was hardened, partly because of the underlying thought that any rational person by now would be believing what Moses has said. The combination of all of those miracles starts looking less likely than the fact that there is just some kind of elaborate coincidence going on. And that brings me to my final point, which is that series of miracles like this reframe the context in a way that seems to me to shape things beyond just making the next miracle more likely than you might have thought in isolation. What do I mean? Well, here the painting might perplex you. But I'm referring to G.K. Chesterton's Orthodoxy and the passage that goes like this. Now, the mere repetition made the things to me rather more weird than more rational. It was as if, having seen a curiously shaped nose in the street and dismissed it as an accident, I had then seen six other noses of the same astonishing shape. I should have fancied for a moment that it must be some local secret society. So one elephant having a trunk was odd. But all elephants having trunks looked like a plot. Or James Bond, once is happenstance, twice is coincidence, three times is enemy action. Now, it seems to me that in these cases, what is going on? Once, okay, that's weird. I can't account for that. So to say that a miracle is an anomaly, well, you might have a decent argument that we shouldn't really believe in a supernatural explanation for anomalies if they occur in isolation. But twice, that's quite a coincidence. Three times, we start reframing the context. We start saying there is something about this situation I do not understand. And why? Because the probability of three remarkably unlikely events occurring in sequence in this way is now far less likely than the appeal to supernatural agency, or at any rate, something outside the system. So we have, for example, Samuel relating to Eli the judgments of God, well, in the painting, but remember how the story begins. One night, Eli, his eyes are so tired, he can barely see, he's lying down, Samuel's lying down in the house of Eli, and the Lord calls Samuel. Samuel says, here I am. He ran to Eli, says, here I am, thinking Eli had called him. Eli said, I didn't call you. Go back to sleep. So he goes in. Same thing happens. Goes back to Eli. Eli said, I didn't call you. Go back to sleep. Weird coincidence that he had that same experience or dream twice. And then the third time, the Lord calls Samuel. Samuel got up and went to Eli and said, here I am. You called me. And at this point, Eli realizes the Lord is speaking to Samuel and says, tell him, speak, Lord, your servant is listening, which he does. Now, the point here is the third time is often the charm. The third one is the one that makes people say, okay, once, I can't explain this, second time, coincidence, third time, now I think there's something else. Enemy action, well, in this case, divine action. There is something outside the framework I've been using to think about this, some other kind of cause. So in general, we reframe the context in the following way. We have a low probability unexplained event. Happenstance. Second one, what a coincidence. Another low probability unexplained event. But by the time we get to the third one, the probabilities now are so remarkably low, we say, wait a minute. There's something going on here that we don't understand. Okay? These things viewed in isolation and just coincidental, they have now an astoundingly low probability. The probability of some other cause lying behind them is higher. So am I really saying that the probability of all three of those is higher than the probability of each one? That seems to violate the laws of probability. Well, yes, I am saying that. But because the context shifts, okay, the probability of those three things happening, given that revised context, enemy action or divine action or a plot of elephants, that suddenly makes all of these things make sense in a way that gives them a much higher probability than each of those alone apart from that context. So here's another way to visualize it. We start with a context. We have one miracle report that expands the context, serves as a context for the second, serves as a context for the third. That's the kind of thing when I was talking about the series in general and the plagues of Egypt. But at some point, you decide, wait, there's a larger context, and there is some cause outside the framework of what I've been thinking about. These are all incredibly unlikely in the absence of such a cause. In the presence of such a cause, they become much more likely. So this gives us a way, I think, of responding to a naturalist's objection, who says, look, what could possibly count as evidence for supernatural purpose, as a sign of God's activity in the world? Maybe no event could best be explained by supernatural agency. You've been saying that there are such events. Well, really, what? Now, I think there's nothing mysterious about this intrinsically. All the time in science, we think about systems and whether they're open or closed. And there's nothing mysterious about arguments that something is not a closed system. Often the best explanation is outside the framework we've been considering. It may be supernatural agency, or it may, within the context of a given physical theory, be something outside the theory. So a classic case, the discovery of Neptune. Some anomalies in the orbit of Uranus. What could account for it? Well, some unknown planet. And indeed, one wobble wasn't enough. That could be a measurement error. Instead, it was a pattern of these perturbations in the Uranus orbit that led people to hypothesize and then discover Neptune. The same thing is true of the discovery of dark matter, if I can call that a discovery, or at any rate, the hypothesis. One constellation, one galaxy appeared not to have enough mass to hang together. It should have just flown off in all directions. What was keeping it together? It couldn't be explained. Well, in one case, an anomaly. There's something weird about that galaxy. But then it started being observed with other galaxies, and people began to hypothesize that in general, there is a kind of matter out there that is invisible, undetectable, but nevertheless massive enough to allow the galaxies to hang together. Well, there are other cases. Actually, not the Blue Man Group in Vegas, but the case of the 11 Blue Men. People in the 1940s in the Bowery in New York who were found sky blue. The first one, bizarre anomaly. But then another one appears. Then another one appears. And it makes people realize there is some common causal factor. It reframes the context and makes people think there is some kind of external cause going on affecting all of those men. Turned out to be people putting sodium nitrite in a salt shaker, and they all sat at the same table. And then finally, and this is the depressing one I will leave you with, the assassination of the Archduke Francis Ferdinand that began World War I. Notice, laid to a Serbian plot. How did they know? Well, Princip was one lone assassin. But earlier in the day, someone had thrown a bomb at the Archduke's car. He batted it away. They revised the route, but the driver took a wrong turn, was backing up when Princip, who had given up, he was the sixth assassin in this chain of assassins, he had given up, went into a bar and was having a beer. Suddenly heard a commotion outside. There was the car, having taken a wrong turn. He jumped out and shot the Archduke. It was not one assassin. After all, you might think that was a lone gunman, one person. What could convince you it was a conspiracy? Well, multiple attempts would certainly do it. And there may be other kinds of evidence as well. So this idea that we're dealing with a system that fully explains things that is closed or must be open, there must be some other cause affecting it, is a common kind of thought, not only in astronomy, but ordinarily in human affairs. The closing thought is that's exactly the kind of reasoning that supports the rationality of belief in miracles. We can think not only that what somebody else has experienced should justify our belief in miracles, but also the things we could experience do it. It doesn't happen in isolation. It happens in series. It happens in combinations that make us reframe the context and realize we can't explain it in the terms that have been previously available to us. Thank you.